I am currently reading New Millennium Boys by Alex Kazemi. This book is great so far. The first part of it, I guess kind of the first act, takes place at a Christian summer camp in 1999. The book then moves with the main character, Brad Sala, into his senior year of high school. And then that's where the book takes place. It's very well researched, very thorough in terms of the references, not only to pop culture, but to candy, things like this, which were part of pop culture, body sprays, lip gloss, lip gels that girls used to use, and the chokers, and what people were wearing. And probably the main thing is the way people talk to each other, and people really did talk to each other that way back then. And it really captures that. It's mostly made up of dialogue, which I think is really interesting. It makes it kind of script-like. It's kind of bare bones in terms of the descriptions, and everything is kind of told through dialogue. And it captures this kind of, I guess, small town milieu, just kind of hanging out in parking lots and being bored with your friends. But it's also, there is something sinister to it. A little bit, it comes out a little bit. It does make the reader feel uncomfortable, or at least it made me feel uncomfortable at times. But it has a real style and fluidity to it. It is realistic, but it's stylized. It's a stylized version of reality at that time. It's a period piece. But I do remember 1999 in parts, and it does really feel like it captures it, and everything feels just right and spot on. It's dense with references, which I love. That's part of the style of it, and it does kind of overdo it with that in a good way. It really loads up the references to the point that it is unrealistic in that respect at times, but again, that adds to the style, and that's part of the overall style of the novel. Oh, and it also was, an excerpt from it was published online years ago. Apparently it went viral. It was called Yours Truly, Brad Sala. And I thought it was Alex Kazemi's, first novel. I thought it was a novel. Then he published Pop Magic, which I loved, really enjoyed. I'm actually rereading it. And then he published this, and it turns out that that was an excerpt from this. So I guess this is his first published novel. I'm not exactly sure, but it feels like a great first novel. Okay, so I have my notes here, and I'm going to be referencing them. Last night, I watched a movie called All Night Long, which I keep wanting to call Up All Night. That is incorrect. Up All Night is a Blink-182 song from their 2011 album, Neighborhoods. All Night Long, on the other hand, is a British film from 1962, directed by Basil Dearden. It is a reworking of Othello. I don't know the story of Othello per se. I mean, I'm sure I know it, but I don't believe I've ever read Othello. I've read other Shakespeare, but not that one. So this is sort of a jazz reworking of it. One of my favorite things about the movie, if not my favorite thing about the movie, was the musical interlude. So you have this story happening, this kind of intrigue in the court story, this drama playing out between the characters at this event, which is being held ostensibly for the character Rex and the character Delia for, I don't know, their anniversary or they're getting married. It wasn't quite clear to me. But in between the story points, you get these jazz interludes with, if I'm not mistaken, the real jazz musicians playing. So you have Dave Brubeck at one point comes in, and he even does a little acting. Not a great actor, but a brilliant pianist, a genius, really. And you see him playing, and the music's incredible, and you see the drummer, and occasionally one of the characters will kind of break out from the story and walk on stage and start playing drums, start playing whatever it is. A couple of times it looked like the audio didn't quite match the visual, like it wasn't that person playing that part. It might have been, it might have just been me imagining. So, all night long, I've been listening this morning to the Celebration of Cinema episode of the Empire Film Podcast, which came out like 2 years ago at this point. But it features Quentin Tarantino and Edgar Wright talking about British film. Edgar Wright goes down this list of British movies that Martin Scorsese had sent him to watch during the pandemic. Quentin Tarantino received the list from Edgar Wright, and then he started making his own list. And Quentin Tarantino brings up All Night Long. There's one Basil Dearden movie on Martin Scorsese's list. It might be Sapphire. But what Quentin Tarantino says is that he's surprised to see, and he says, you know, kind of not to be insulting, but he says it's kind of a surprise to see a British movie from that era being so fucking hip. And All Night Long is so fucking hip. He also refers to Basil Dearden as one of the more race-conscious filmmakers of that time. There definitely is an element of race in this movie. Rex is a black man, jazz musician, ends up firing this guy who they call him a hophead. I would call him now in today's day and age, I would call him a marijuana addict. It's interesting the way they deal with marijuana in this movie. They're very kind of open about it. And they treat it as something that you can get addicted to, which actually is forward thinking for 1962, in my opinion. So this is available on the Criterion Channel to stream as part of their British Noir collection. Now, to me, this movie is not a noir per se, but it's shot like a noir, which was very interesting to me, especially the exteriors, that you get these kind of inky blacks and these kind of stark whites, and it's in black and white, obviously. And it looks like a noir, but it isn't really a noir story. There isn't really a crime element. It's Othello, it's a drama. And it also could totally work on stage as a play. In fact, I think it would be very cool to have a jazz band on stage, have them do the interludes, and then have the actors playing out the story. It all takes place in one location in this kind of loft, I guess loft apartment, where they're holding this event. Or maybe it's like a nightclub that they've rented out for the night. I don't know. That also was unclear to me. So, yeah, what Tarantino said was, like, if you put this, I guess, together with Sapphire and, is it Yield to the Night? I don't know what the other one was. All Night Long, Sapphire. Okay, yeah, it's not The Asphyxiate. It is Sapphire that Basil Dearden directed. I don't know what the other one that he mentioned was now. This podcast episode is dense with references. They talk about a lot of British movies, a lot of which I haven't seen. I'm not a British film expert, but I'm getting there. Partly thanks to the Criterion Channel. It might be Yield to the Night. Edgar Wright mentions that this is available as part of a Criterion box set called The London Underground with Sapphire, maybe Pool of London, maybe Yield to the Night. I'm not sure what else is in that box set. I'm not sure if it's even available any longer. I would hope that it is, and I would urge anyone listening to pick up a copy. This is Maxwell Haddad, and you're listening to Video Nasties. I also wanted to mention that I began watching Clerks 3 last night. So this is coming, is it almost 20 years after Clerks 2? Can I really be that old? Clerks 2 was, I think, 2006, and this is 2023. And this is a fun little movie. It's there's definitely an element of sadness to it, but there's a lot of humor, a lot of jokes. Not all of it works. It's a little goofy, a little stupid. It's definitely, I think it is kind of a nice combination of different eras in Kevin Smith's career. He had his kind of first era, which is still his best, which is, I demarcate it with Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. That's like part two of his career. So then Jersey Girl and Clerks 2 are part of that. But then the first period is Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Dogma, his best movies, his best four movies besides Tusk, which I liked. So you get the next part, which I guess, yeah, you kind of get the next four. As I said, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, Jersey Girl, which is his attempt at making a commercial movie. It's his most commercial movie, or at least that's what he was attempting. Then you get Clerks 2 and Zack and Mary Make a Porno. And then you get into the horror movie stage, which is the third part of his career. So you get Red State, Tusk, and then Yoga Hosers. And then the fourth stage of his career begins, in my opinion, with, unless I'm missing one, Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, and now Clerks 3, so it's kind of those two. He also, I think he directed, there was another one that he directed, another horror movie. I can't think of the name of it. He directed a segment of Holidays, which was a horror, holiday horror anthology. And then, I want to call it Chan is Missing, but it's not. There's another one that he directed. It was like independently financed, something like that. I'm forgetting, but really I'm thinking of these two movies, which are sort of like the culmination of his career. And in some ways they're his best movies. They're his most accomplished, certainly as a director, also as a writer. They're packed with jokes. They're smart. Even though I just said it's stupid and smart. And they're really playing to his fans and giving them a nice sort of capper on his career, while also dealing with things that he's dealing with in his personal life, especially with this movie, because it deals with a heart attack. Randall has a heart attack at the beginning of the movie. So it starts off in Quick Stop. They're back in Quick Stop. So at first I was thinking, okay, this is actually more similar to the first Clerks than Clerks 2 was, because most of Clerks 2 is set at movies, at A movies where they work. And then in this one, you see Dante back at Quick Stop, and it's kind of, you see the age on his face, and it's kind of funny, but also a little somber, perhaps, to see him still working there. And then Randall has a heart attack. So Randall still works at RST, which, I guess they also sell weed there. It says, there's a sign covering it saying THC. Kevin Smith is now a stoner, so that's part of his personal life leaking into the movies. So anyway, Randall has a heart attack and he's brought to hospital. You get kind of the kooky hospital workers there, the kooky male nurse played by Justin Long, and then the kooky doctor played by Amy Sedaris. Some of it's funny, some of it's just kind of overdone, overly goofy. We also get the return of Trevor Furman, who played Elias. Yeah, and he's part of he has his own Silent Bob now, played by Austin Zizur, who's annoying, but also okay in the movie. He's Kevin Smith's daughter's boyfriend in real life. So, Harley Quinn Smith. Is that her name? Harley Quinn Smith. Yeah, and him are together in real life, or they were. And he's in the movie as the kind of new Silent Bob, which to me is Kevin Smith kind of tipping his hat at him. He's an actor, not a very good actor. Anyway, so they're part of the Christian Crypto Club, I think it's called, and which is kind of like this weird Christian cult thing. And anyway, he's in it a lot. Elias is in it a lot. He's kind of a pivotal character. I stopped the movie while they're still at the hospital. I didn't get any further than that. Not for any reason other than I wanted to get up and get some food or whatever it was, take a shower. So I can't speak on where the movie goes, but just based on Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, which I did watch in its entirety, it could go to some unexpected places. Jay and Silent Bob Reboot kind of, I don't know, it felt bigger than other Kevin Smith movies in a way, at least his more recent movies. I think maybe his biggest feeling movie is Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. It's the one that feels most like a studio movie, the least like an independent movie, I would say. Maybe along with Dogma, but I think even more so, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. I think he did have some money to make those movies, though he's never had like a real budget. Zack and Mary Make a Porno is a little this, but I don't know, it just feels, even this, this along with Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, they just feel bigger, and they feel like they have a lot packed into them. A lot of jokes, a lot of information, and a lot of references to Kevin Smith's personal life, maybe too many references to his personal life. If you've listened to, or if you've watched one of his shows, his speaking shows, Silent But Deadly, that kind of thing, or you've listened to podcasts that he's been on, interviews with him, or you've listened to his own podcasts, he talks about the story of having a heart attack, and it's exactly the way it is in the movie. In 80% of the cases where there's 20%, where there's 100% occlusion, which is what you have, the patient always dies, which is, I think, exactly what the doctor said to him, and it's what Amy Sedaris says to him in the movie. So he's lifting these things directly from real life and repeating them continuously, I think, to the point of oversaturation. Like, I think it's too lifted from real life. There's not enough imagination going into it, which has maybe always been a problem with Kevin Smith's cinema. Or not even, shouldn't even call it cinema, but Kevin Smith's movies or Kevin Smith's work. There's just not enough imagination there. But it's also, it also makes it kind of interesting, and he does focus on the characters and the dialogue, which I like, and which is refreshing, given the current climate where there's not enough focus on character and dialogue. So this movie worked for me more than it didn't, but I also only got about 20 minutes in, so I'm sure you'll be hearing more about it right here on Video Nasties. Just to give you even more context for Basil Dearden's All Night Long, I will read the description from the Criterion Channel. As I said, it's part of their British Noir collection. It is 1 hour 31 minutes. This is All Night Long, Basil Dearden, 1962, United Kingdom. Directed by Basil Dearden, just to be clear. Othello is translated to the world of 60s London jazz clubs. Sorry, I'm just making sure it's still recording. 60s London jazz clubs and Basil Dearden's smoky and sensational All Night Long. Over the course of one eventful evening, the anniversary celebration of, okay, so it is their anniversary, the anniversary celebration of the musical and romantic partners Aurelius Rex, Paul Harris, and Delia Lane, Marty Stevens, a jealous, ambitious drummer, Johnny Cousin, Patrick McGowan, attempts to tear the interracial couple apart. This daring psychodrama also features on-screen appearances by jazz legends Charles Mingus, yep, he's in it right at the beginning, Dave Brubeck, as I said, so it really is him, Tubby Hayes, and Johnny Dankworth. It said the names at the beginning, but I still didn't quite believe that it was really these legends, but it was. It was sort of unclear to me that Patrick McGowan's character, Johnny Cousin, was attempting to tear apart Rex and Delia. That was never quite clear to me, but it makes sense now that I read it after having watched most of the movie. I did fall asleep, so I didn't see the ending, but I saw most of it. I would say I saw a good hour of it. New Millennium Boys is the best thing that I've read all year in terms of the things that have been published this year, along with Quentin Tarantino's Cinema Speculation and Brady Snell's The Shards, which I believe were both published early this year. It seems so long ago now that I bought those, but I believe they're from this year. Although, you know what? Wait a minute. I think Cinema Speculation was last year, and The Shards was early this year. I think it was like November and then January. I remember they came out like a few months apart. So when it comes to end of the year lists, you can expect to see both The Shards and New Millennium Boys on my list of my favorite books from this year. I'm recording this on two separate days, so I'm not quite sure what I said earlier in the episode, but I believe I referred to New Millennium Boys by Alex Kazemi as being light on description, light on descriptive prose, kind of bare bones in that respect, which isn't exactly true. The descriptions are really interesting. It is mostly made up of dialogue, that is true. But I think I was just saying the other thing because Freddie Sinella said it on his podcast. I mean, partly because of that. But I don't totally agree with it. I think the descriptions are actually very detailed and really interesting and kind of remind me of American Psycho, the way, just how detailed they are and the way everything's described, the clothes, the perfume, the albums, all of it. So there's that, and there's something else I wanted to say, but I'm not remembering it right now. I remember now. I wanted to refer to the style of the novel, which is sort of this, the story, as it were, even though it's really not story-based, the novel is structured in a way that... The novel is essentially made up of snippets. It's pieces of this young man's life, first when he's at summer camp and then when he's in high school, the people who he's interacting with. I just read a chapter where he's in an older girl's bedroom and they're kind of arguing about feminism. And then it moves into what is the, there is a story there, and it moves into what is the story of the novel or the plot of the novel, which is this love story between Aurora and Brad. He asks her about, what should I write in a love letter? And Freddie Sinella did give a little bit away. I hadn't gotten to the part where they're writing love letters to each other. So I was at a point when I listened to the Freddie Sinella podcast episode with Alex Kazemi where I didn't know if he would ever see Aurora again or even refer to her again. The novel is realistic in that people just kind of disappear from the novel and you never really hear about them again. Daniel seemed like such an important character early on, and he hasn't even been mentioned in the last 20 pages or so. And speaking of the Freddie Sinella's podcast episode with Alex Kazemi, it's a great episode. I've listened to it twice all the way through. I'm listening to it a third time now. And it's clear that they are friends of a sort. They text each other. Alex Kazemi texts Freddie Sinella about, with his takes on things, especially awards shows. And the VMAs are mentioned in the book. And I think Alex Kazemi has this thing with award shows that I also have, so I can relate to it. I have a weird obsession with them. And he always seems to have a take on them. He also talks about his take on The Idol. He talks about it as being kind of disappointing, which it was. Or at least that's how I'm reading what he said. It was disappointing to me. And it seemed like him and the culture at large were sort of disappointed by it as well. Now, maybe the most important thing he said, and this refers to what I just said, and I'm contradicting myself, is that really there isn't a culture anymore. There is no popular culture, that's for sure, but really there isn't a culture at all anymore, I don't think. And Alex Kazemi doesn't seem to think so either. I think probably the most important thing he said during the entire episode, which is part one of two, it's the first hour of Ellis's conversation with Kazemi, which is how he's structuring his episodes now. The most important thing Alex Kazemi said on this new episode of the Freddie Sinella podcast is this. He doesn't believe that there is a culture war. He thinks it's made up, it's fake. And he said that in order for there to be a culture war, there would have to be a culture. And there isn't a culture anymore, unfortunately. I also wanted to mention that I've had Blink-182 on the brain. This is why I referred to the band earlier, probably, or one of the reasons why. The reason why I've had Blink-182 on the brain is that in Alex Kazemi's novel, New Millennium Boys, Blink-182 is often referred to because Brad Sella is a big fan of the band, so they're often mentioned.
This has been a production of Reptilian.